and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Feature Interviews. Today I have a fabulous guest whose film, Flea, I actually don't know where you can find it, but he will tell us, I'm sure. Brian McQuarrie?
Yes.
Oh, I got it right. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
I have a few questions just to start. Is this based on a true story of any kind?
It is not, but it's inspired by some of the things I've gone through personally.
Okay, so can we discuss those?
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell me, why did we write this film then? What personally hit you to write this?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm the proud son of a Chicago police officer and the grandson of a Chicago police officer, and wearing my dad's police watch. Neither of them are with us anymore. So I come from a law enforcement family, and I'm from Chicago. And in 2016 in Los Angeles, I was the victim of a violent crime. And I was not expected to make it. They put me in a paralytic coma on ECMO and on a ventilator. Oh. And a week later, I came out of the coma. My jaw was wired shut. I had a lot of questions. I couldn't speak. I asked for, I motioned for pen and paper. I started writing questions. My coordination was completely thrown off from the coma. So I was writing chicken scratch. So the issue was I had my oxygen level dropped to critical levels. So my mom sat there as I was writing chicken scratch thinking I had brain damage and this is the new normal and we'll just deal with it. And the next day or the day after, they brought an alphabet chart and I couldn't even point to the letters I wanted on the alphabet chart because my coordination was off. So it began this long process of they would point to like, okay, this column, which letter do you want? No, this column. And I would spell words one letter at a time. So you learn to be very succinct. And then I had to learn to walk again. They had to get me out of bed. I had to learn to walk again. So I went through that. Then once I was out of the ICU, the police came to see if I could identify who did it. And I did. And they already knew, but this was corroboration. And then I found out when I got out of the hospital, they only charged him with a misdemeanor and had no intention to arrest him. So then I had to advocate with the DA's office and get felony charges. And then the felony charges and felony arrest warrant were issued. And then the LAPD said, we don't have the resources to find him. So then we had to advocate with LAPD. And then they went out and they found him and got him in custody. And eventually he took a plea deal and he's now a convicted felon.
Wow, that's a big story to get to here. So I see elements of what you're talking about in your script. So that obviously helped you to write this.
Right. I channeled the effects of the trauma, the advocacy, the frustration, all of that into a fictional story.
I definitely think you get across your frustration. Okay. Like I definitely feel your main protagonist is frustrated 24/7. And then I find maybe that was your plan with your interviews, your cutscenes, to bring me more frustration through them. Because everybody we meet seems to agree with him, but he's not getting anywhere. Okay. So let's go into the movie a bit more. Now, when you were designing the movie, would you do the basic writing of your main character and his problem? And then add the cutscenes, or were the cutscenes already written in the first draft?
I wrote it in a very unusual way. I used the notes app on my phone. And I would write whenever I had time, wherever I was. And I believe I started just writing each documentary interview as a monologue.
Okay, I can see that. That works for me.
And then I wrote the scenes with Tom alone and advocating. And there was only initially one scene with the sister. Because in the first draft, Tom was interviewed in the documentary, his sister, the prosecutor, it was everyone. And then... So I wrote all of that, and then I would basically import that into Final Draft and format it and kind of polish and move things around. And then I wrote the whole kidnapping storyline straight through as one narrative, and then went put that into Final Draft and basically started finding the exact structure and moving pieces around.
So how did you feel when the actor would come in? You're like, hey, I just need to read this monologue. You're not going to really interact with anybody. Just read the monologue. Is that what you told them? So it was easy to piece it to film it? Or was it all at once?
We filmed all in pieces, actually, each piece. you know, and just did a series of takes, and I sat in as the interviewer off camera. So not only could I prompt them, but I could also give direction, and we'd just roll series of takes until we felt like, okay, we got that chunk. You know, some of them were significant chunks. Some of them were one or two lines at a time, but we broke it up like that.
Okay, I'm just going to go back to the cutscenes, and I'll leave it, I promise. Okay. Is it all the same room? It looks like at one point you just switch boxes out on me.
No.
They're all different rooms.
All different rooms, some completely different places entirely, yeah.
Wow, okay. The one I wasn't sure about was the one with the couch, because you told me it was all the same. So I said, okay, one side has the desk, the other side has the couch. The boxes switch, because there's one shot you do, a guy has boxes with labels on it, and the other one is a room with same boxes idea. So there are different rooms just with boxes.
Well, yeah, the one is a lawyer's office where he's got piles of, you know, boxes with his stuff, and then the other is a garage where we see all her storage because she was looking for photos. But then the other, the police detective is in a, you know, dining room. And then the other one is with the couch is, you know, like a den. So, yeah, all different.
So did you have actors in mind when you were shooting those scenes, or did you put a general blanket out there saying, hey, I need people?
I had actors in mind. I mean, I had actors in mind when I wrote it, and I got some of them and not others because of scheduling or didn't want to do it type of thing. And then I worked as an assistant director for 10 years and I've made short films. So I kind of have a Rolodex of actors that I know are good and are easy to work with. And then from that point, when I needed other options, I went to actor friends. Eddie, who plays Hardy Knight, he's a member of the Actor Studio. So he recommended a bunch of actors, three of whom are in the movie. Steve Mize, who plays Tom, the detective, played by Marty Ryan, and then the witness at the park, played by Renee Rivera. They're all Actor Studio members. So I just trusted. I kept the circle, though. I didn't put out big casting notices because I wanted to know that these were people that were down for a small independent film, easy to work with, wanted to be there, that type of thing.
Okay, so how easy was it to go from assistant directing when you're helping out? Obviously, you do have work to do, but now you're in charge of the whole thing. Seamless, probably, if you've been doing it for 10 years.
Well, yeah, I started making short films, and then an actor in one of my short films said, hey, I'm making a horror feature, and he had a horror actress that's pretty well known in it. And he said, will you be my assistant director? I said, sure. And it was cool because it was my first day ever being an assistant director. She pulled me inside and said, you're really good at this. How long have you been doing it? Ah! I said, started today.
That's awesome.
So that in that respect, just having years of set experience, but I actually directed before I assistant directed, which is kind of backwards.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. Okay. I want to discuss a few props here that I did notice. At the beginning of the film, you have an old cigar box, convinced it's an old cigar box. He's opening up and taking things out. Beautiful prop. I'm sure most people have no idea what that is, but I'm old enough to remember those. So where do you have that lying around? Did you just bring it? Oh, I'll bring that in.
It was my grandfather's that I essentially inherited, you know, when he passed away. You know, some of us kept certain things that we wanted and didn't want to get rid of. And it's always been with me. Wherever I've lived, whether it was in storage or in my home. And in this case, everything's in our house now. We don't have storage. And I just started looking for stuff that might be sitting around in someone's garage, you know, and it looked cool.
I do think it looks cool. Now, I want to discuss, this garage is very clean. So I guess you had no problems moving your camera around, or did you take stuff out of this garage to film?
We had to move some stuff to make room, but it's pretty well organized, our garage, so there wasn't a lot to do with it.
So how did you find sitting in the car trying to get your shots? Cause, I mean, you really don't give me a reveal right off the beginning. It's very quiet reveal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew it was coming. It kind of does explain itself, but in the beginning, I have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. So how did you find shooting your angle so you don't give things away?
I wanted just to be very, very simple. I mean, we shot the actress. Actually, the way we shot it, she did both phone calls, calling the other actors live on the phone in the take. and straight through. I mean, they were all so good and so prepared that there were just takes of the whole thing all the way through for like 10 minutes.
Interesting.
I just wanted to keep that very simple and be with her, you know, and what she's going through. And I didn't want to film cutaways of the people on the phone and wherever they were and what they were up to. I just really wanted you to be with Olivia.
I quite laughed at the school scene. The school chat, the phone made me laugh because I really believe that happened to you.
Yeah, I mean, I made it up, but yeah, I think there are those policies, and rightfully so, in making sure kids can't just get picked up by any adult.
Well, that's exactly, because I've been through that, making a list, and I was dying listening to that. Like, that's so true.
And I'm sure there are parents that don't provide the list and just think, oh, it's fine, one of us will get.
Well, that's usually with us. We did that, then we realized maybe we should put a couple people on the list just in case, that once time that we're not available.
Yeah, I worked in an after-school program in high school where I was like a volunteer and worked with the kids. And I remember even back then, this is 1991, they had a security door that you had to buzz in, and they had a list, and they were strict about it, you know, because this is the last thing anyone wants to hear is a child was abducted at their after-school program. You know, exactly. They're supposed to be safe.
So when people are watching this film, are they on the edge of their seat? Because you have no idea. You never give away the ending of this film, ever. I have no idea where we're going to end up.
People seem very surprised, which I'm happy with. They don't.
Definitely.
They can't predict where it's going or what's going to happen.
I'm not going to talk about the end, but I am going to ask a question about the end. Because you obviously have directed it and seen it, so you think you might have it. Was there ever?
Don't reveal who the kidnapper is.
I'm not going to.
Okay.
I have no interest in revealing that. Was there ever a different ending, a more of a final ending?
No.
Okay, so it's always just supposed to be up to me.
Yeah, there was an even more abrupt thought for the ending, which essentially would have removed the final shot.
Oh, that would have hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought about it, and actually when it screened at the first film festival, someone asked me, did you ever think about ending it here? I said, I did, but it's just much more, even though it's not a quote-unquote satisfying ending, it's more satisfying, I think, with the final shot.
Interesting. I love the beautiful court drawings. I thought they were lovely. Who did those?
Those were done by a very old friend of mine named John Stangland. He has worked in the comic book industry. He owns a comic book store called Atlas Comics in Chicago.
Here's my plug.
He's the 35-year anniversary sale this weekend. So he's been doing it a long time, and I contacted him, and he as far as I know, he had a lot of fun doing it.
Oh, it was wonderful. I thought your music was different. Like, at times it's very commanding. Mm-hmm. At times you pull it back and let it just be subtle underneath. Mm-hmm. That kind of hind you were hiding it on me a couple of times. I really thought it was hidden. I'm like, that's music.
Okay.
It took me back because I was trying to think, were you doing sound editing or music a couple of times?
Well, we have two composers, actually.
Ah, okay. That would help me.
We treated the documentary as its own thing because in the logic of the story, it would exist as its own thing. So that was one composer. That was Barry J. Neely, who I'd worked with before. And he developed a few different themes. And then Patrick Donahoe did the bulk of the movie, the narrative. And the kidnapping theme, I'll call it, every piece is a different riff, a different, totally different piece of music. They're all kind of the same whole. But Pat really wanted to experiment and do different things, and some, like you said, are more subtle than others. Some are really in your face, and some are just there giving tension and hopefully making you uneasy. And he also developed the theme for Joanna the Wife, which is one of my favorite pieces. It's a very emotional piece that we kind of recur and mash up at times.
Okay. Well, I was going to get to Joanne, don't worry, someone. Actually, the idea for the husband and wife videos, they're very good. I thought they felt very realistic. So is this based on your real life, or you just made that one up too?
Just made it up. Just wanted to find ways for you to meet Joanna and feel the loss Tom goes through without just saying, oh, he's going through loss, oh, he's going through trauma, like giving you that glimpse of their relationship so you know he really lost something special.
Like, how much work did you have to do with Tom? Or Tom just came in with that emotion? Because he seems real to me. Like, I really felt Tom was not acting at any time. Like, he seemed to get the character and just come in, boom, I understand this.
Yeah, we had long conversations beforehand because we shot during COVID, and because of the nature of that, there was no rehearsal period, very strict filming protocols and testing and all that. So he did a lot of prep. I mean, he's a terrific actor. He's a member of the Actors Studio. He just really cared about this project and this role. So he did a lot of his own prep, and then he would call me or email me with questions and ideas and thoughts, and we would just talk about all that, and I would give him as many answers and as much information as I could. Because Eddie Kaler, who plays Hardy Knight, because the two of them in real life are old friends, that I think helped that relationship because they have a real relationship to build on. But the other actors were new actors to him, and he just came ready to go.
Did you want to spend more time in the car shooting? Because I felt you could have done a little bit more with the car while it was moving. Or you just felt you were going to use the cutscenes to fill that stuff in, I needed to know.
Yeah, I didn't want to just exposition in those scenes. I wanted to kind of, you get information in the documentary and then they're arguing about it, as opposed to just them explaining it all to the audience in the car. It's funny because when Heather Langenkamp read the script, she said, I want more of that kidnapping storyline. Like, that's my part. And so I wrote what Anne calls Olivia's monologue late in the film, where she's talking to Tom and he's not responding. I added that, and I added another scene late in the film back in as well with them, because I'm not going to argue when someone gives me a good note. Like, we need more of this, you know.
I agree with her. You could even add another 5 minutes. I would have been totally happy with the conversation. I enjoyed that. I think I liked Tom so much as an actor that I wanted more of him. Anytime I have Tom, I'm happy. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with anybody else. I just love Tom.
Okay.
He sold me. Right, this thing, I'm like, I like this guy. I could watch things with him again. I enjoy his company.
Yeah, it's terrific.
And also because you're directing, right? I mean, if you're not doing a good job, I'm not going to enjoy that either. Okay, out in the forest. I do always have to ask questions when we're out in the forest. Did you get gawkers or anything, or was it just a quiet forest because it was COVID?
It's private property, so
okay.
We had totally to ourselves.
Okay. That's all the good questions. I always ask this question. So you've told me you've written on script. You told me on final draft. Does anybody else get to read your script besides the actors? I mean, you gave it to Heather Langenkamp, which is wonderful. Does your wife read it? Best friends read it? Do you take notes for them or just want to hear their opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I did. I initially sent it to an actor named Dean Cameron. And wanted him to do it, and it didn't work out schedule wise, but Dean read it. And as I mentioned earlier, I had more characters in the documentary before, and Dean felt like the Tom and the sister Ruth in the documentary just didn't really work the way it was written. And he urged me to really take a look at that. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to hear from him was, I love this screenplay. Let's go make it, you know, but I was smart enough to step back and listen to what he said and think about it. And it helped me because I then took them out of the documentary and dramatized more scenes with Tom and his sister and more scenes in the kidnapping, and just broke out of the documentary format somewhat and made a better screenplay. I sent it to Heather. She talked about the kidnapping story. I sent it to my writer friend, Joe Madry. He gave me a bunch of specific notes. My mom read it and she ended up being our main investor. Another friend came in with the last chunk of money we needed. So yeah, I mean, I wasn't precious about it. I wanted to get feedback. And, I think the key is find people whose opinion you really respect and then listen to them when they tell you things, whether they're good or critical.
So My last question is, on your statement, you said you wish people would talk about things more often. This kind of idea. This was in your thing. You sent it to me. Has that happened?
Sure, yeah.
Has that happened? Has this opened up? Oh, my God. Now you're definitely...
Man, you're breaking up again. You're frozen again.
I know. Okay, let's back this up.
Do you see me?
Yes, but you're frozen on me now. Last time you weren't. Now this time you are frozen.
I can't even understand you.
Okay, we'll wait. Are we good? Are we good? Are we okay?
Yeah.
Just rebooted. This could be a great edit for me. Lots of fun. Okay.
I know.
Back we go. At the end of the description you sent me, you said, I hope this helps people discuss these kind of crimes. Did this happen? Do you feel your film has helped that?
It hasn't been seen by enough people yet, but I'm hoping, you know, to have more of that dialogue. We have a bunch of film festival screenings coming up and, you know, we're going to pursue distribution. So I certainly hope it sparks that conversation because I think, like my mom joked in my case, if my case was on Blue Bloods, Donnie Wahlberg would have caught the guy and he would have been sent to prison in, you know, in the hour. And I think we have that false reality of television and movies and police. And the reality is there's a lot of good people, and I dealt with a lot of good people, even though I was frustrated. But the system is so overwhelmed and the resources are so limited that you have to make them care about your case and your circumstance. And I have a feeling when the DA's office first heard about my case, they heard 30 seconds from an assistant DA. And then when I finally got a supervisor on the phone and explained what happened and what I went through, I could tell he was hearing this and learning this for the first time. So that made him reassess and look at it and, you know, make a different decision. And then LAPD, again, it's the person in my case had hurt someone before. There was an arrest warrant out for him already when he hurt me. And hopefully now that he's a convicted felon, he won't hurt anyone else. Or maybe he'll think twice before he resorts to violence in a situation. There's no guarantees, but at least I did something to hold him accountable. But that advocacy is so important because it's not just going to happen because it should. Sometimes it will, but that's not certain.
Okay, so before I get to fun questions, your film is only available on the film circuit right now. There's no YouTube, yes, private screeners, anything like that. Nothing they can pay for.
Correct, just
okay,
the film.
So tell people before we get to fun questions, before I forget, where can they see your film next? What film festival are you doing?
Okay, on October 6th, it's going to be at the First Glance Philadelphia Film Festival. And also on October 6th, it's going to be in Glendale, California at the SYS's Six-Figure Film Festival. So both coasts basically on the same day. It's going to play in later in October, mid-October, at the Treasure Coast Film Festival in Florida. And then at the end of the month in the Mesa International Film Festival in Mesa, Arizona.
And which ones will you be attending?
I'll be in Glendale, California, and hopefully Arizona.
Awesome. Well, those are an easy drive for you from one to the other, which is good.
Yeah.
Okay, fun questions. Your favorite film, please?
My favorite film is It's a Wonderful Life.
Number two, one actor you will work with in the future?
Oh, boy, that I hope to work with in the future.
I always like to say you will because I like to have faith.
Okay.
I hope to. It's fine.
Let me think. Sally Field.
Oh, I think that's possible, actually. She's not working a lot. Really. I mean, she did the 80 for Brady, I think was her last.
She did 80 for Brady.
So you got a chance. I think Sally Field will do your independent movie. I have faith. One film you always should recommend to people, but they never watch.
That they never watch.
Everybody has that film.
I'm going to say Eye of God by Tim Blake Nelson, though I have gotten some people to watch it.
Good work. I've never heard of it. So you might have the Eye of God?
Eye of God. It's with Nick Stahl when he was very young, and it's with I'm going to blank on everyone else. Richard Jenkins, he's in it.
I'm in.
It's got a terrific ensemble cast.
That's all I heard you hear is Richard Jenkins. You sold me right there on Richard Jenkins. I want to thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Hey, it's Simon from the Extra Features Podcast. Thank you for listening. Please check out our YouTube channel if you'd like to see a live interview. Also, if possible, we love donations at PayPal. And if you can't do that, no problem. Please rate and review at iTunes and Spotify. Thank you. Bye.